Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Sarcini.
I'm Devinder Hardwar.
I'm Dwayne DeFreitas.
And I'm Chris Benoit.
This week we have a ton of Apple news, including revealing evidence uncovered in the ongoing Apple-Samsung trial and how one tech reporter's online identity was demolished as a result of a social engineering hack on Apple and Amazon tech support. But first, we occasionally like to do a segment on the show we call What We're Playing With, where we talk about the gadgets, apps, and tech that has obsessed us over the last week. And there's about two or three things I wanted to talk about. One is a episode of the Revision 3 show called Toasted Donut. Now, Toasted Donut is hosted by the former cameraman of the Dig Nation podcast. And in fact,
wow. It's all nepotism up in there.
Oh, totally. Revision 3 is totally like that. He's actually a pretty cool personality. And in fact, Toasted Donut took over the RSS feed for Dig Nation. So Dig Nation subscribers automatically get Toasted Donut. On this last week's show, he had as a guest Dan Heward, who was one of the community managers over at Dig. And in the light of all this, we've been talking back and forth the last few weeks about the death of Dig and the rebirth of the new Dig. So
It sounds like Neon Genesis Evangelion, death and rebirth and all that stuff.
So it's been an ongoing topic, and so he talked to Dan Heward, who is a community manager. Dan goes into this great detail about what it was like to be on his side of things, watching all the users try and exploit the system to get their stories to the front of the home page, and basically all the stress that he went through as a firewall to prevent the mass of spammers from hitting the Dig's front page, as well as all of the legitimate users who collectively revolted at one time or another to influence the front page. And it's a really fascinating interview if you were a Dig user, and particularly if you were a Dig Power user. I know that's a smaller subset of people, but it's a fascinating interview. My only qualm about it is it's too short. I would love to hear more from Dan Heward or anybody over at Dig about what it was like on their end. But it's a fascinating thing to listen to if you get a chance to check it out. It's at revision3.com, and it's called Toasted Donut. And check that out. Another thing I want to talk about is a couple of weeks ago we talked about Ouya, the Kickstarter project whose goal is to market a low-cost Android-based gaming console.
I've decided to pronounce it Ouya.
Ouya. I think it's kind of... It's,
that's exactly
yeah,
what I meant.
Yeah, you can pronounce it like that. I think they want it to sound like that. But since last we spoke, Ouya has had quite a few notable milestones. By the time you hear this on our recorded podcast, funding will have closed, and they've met and exceeded their $950,000 goal by over 800%. They've also formed partnerships with OnLive, Vivo, XBMC, Namco Bandai, and Square Enix, with Square Enix bringing in an exclusive HD port of Final Fantasy III as a launch title. And I think it's time to start considering Ouya as a serious contender in the console market.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty impressive. It's rolling out in March. At least that's the scheduled date. So I think Devinger said it best. He was like, dude, it's a long time for a console rollout, especially when it's like mobile technology that like dies every 3 months. But I think that the iPad, I said this back in 2010,
it's going to be more about the service providers that have signed on with it than it is going to be about the hardware. So long as the hardware can handle the software they're going to throw on it.
Yeah, no, I think that is like half the battle right there. It doesn't matter how high powered your system is or what features it has. I mean, nowadays it's all about the content partnerships, and it sounds like they've really kind of started to develop a nice stable of partners for this. This is like the most confident that I've ever felt about a Kickstarter project, despite the fact that I actually have not taken delivery of a single Kickstarter project so far. This is the one that I feel the most confident about. I think even more so than the Pebble, which seems pretty solid too.
Pebble has done pretty well on tour. I mean, I haven't seen a Pebble one, but I they have a billboard.
No, but they solidified their colors, right? So like orange is going to be the chosen color, the fourth color. Like people voted, and I voted for orange, so I'm excited about that. And I think that's the one I'm going to get, the orange watch. And they are still on schedule for September. To me, it's going to be like an early birthday present. I really wish I'd gotten two, because it would have made a great present for a geek. You know what I mean?
The thing I always have with Kickstarter projects is like, can you actually deliver? I mean, it's certainly nice to be able to market your product, and that's you know, great. I mean, marketing is an important part of starting a business. There's certainly plenty of businesses that have failed with awesome engineering teams and no ability to market, but we're just begging the opposite question. I mean, can you build this thing that you've done such a good job marketing? Right. I mean, I could go on and market, you know, the most awesome thing ever, but have limited technical abilities. And
it's an important question. Like, it's something I also think we need to consider more when talking about all these cool ass Kickstarter projects, because the first time we wrote about a couple Adventure Beat, we got nothing but avalanches of Kickstarter spam of people like saying their product is awesome. And even a lot of other news sites just like jump on anything that seems vaguely interesting on Kickstarter. There's some sort of weird glut of like Kickstarter love here that most of these companies probably won't be able to deliver, at least not the way we're expecting them to.
I feel like the thing about it is that the promise of Kickstarter is like this idea that, you know, you're going to put money down and there are other people here who see what you see in this fledgling product. And there's a little bit of this idea that like, oh, I know what's up because I'm part of I'm up on the, you know, it's technology. And so everyone wants to be there first, you know, everyone wants to be seeing it before everybody does it, touching it before everybody else does. So there's a little bit of that like collective mentality of this is going to be hot. Sure. And when it gets hot, like a YouTube video, suddenly, you know, they hit this critical mass and then people start watching that video, giving that video more like views, or in the case of Kickstarter, depending on the price, giving that, you know, that device more love. And then, so I think the difference is the reason why it does catch wildfire is because on some level, people are willing to, it's like a risk without risk. Even if it screws up and it doesn't work, you didn't do it alone. There are all these thousands of people who are on board with you. So it's not your fault, or it wasn't bad, whatever. And, you know, you do like, you know, money, you know, the money isn't completely lost. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Let me ask everybody else. Has anybody here taken delivery on a Kickstarter project yet?
Pebble was my first one. So.
Yeah, Pebble was my first like one over $100. Ah. So yeah. I've done like some for like indie films and things like that.
Yeah, books and physical films.
But have you seen any of them deliver?
So I think so. I have to go back and check.
I've gotten one. I supported Fake Grimlock, and I received my posters from him.
There you go.
Cool.
Well, there you go.
And one of my friends from high school is, I don't know, he keeps posting himself. I don't know. Yeah. Given that I know him from high school, I'm pretty sure I'm going to get what I... But, you know, again, those were fairly small ones. I think the advantage of Kickstarter... And I think there is an advantage of Kickstarter. I think particularly for the, like, consumer... The mass market consumer electronics market, like Pebble and Ouya, because... So Startup Digest shares office space with a company called SlidePad, which is in the bicycle business. They made a new type of bicycle brake that makes it much more difficult to flip over your handlebars if you stop too quickly. It's pretty ingenious. Anyway, watching a hardware startup sort of work through you know, they have an awesome idea, they have an awesome engineering team, but the problem with doing a hardware startup is you have to put in a huge amount of money before you ever go to market. You have to, you know, you have to come up with your prototype, and that's usually fairly cheap, but then you have to, you know, go to Taiwan and, you know, build a few hundred thousand of your product, and then you,
and
have,
you have to go to Taiwan. Let's see, let's get there like first. You have to like think about it this way. You've got these Americans who are like with an idea trying to do some stuff, and then you have to find a broker in Taiwan who's going to speak Taiwanese and not screw you. And the hardware, the quality of the hardware you're trying to create has to be on par with your prototype or better. There's just a lot of like logistical stuff that people who are the four guys in a startup or whatever are not prepared to deal with from a life experience level. You know what I mean?
Well, and even if you are experienced, I mean, just part of being experienced in the hardware market is realizing that, you know, it's this chicken and egg problem where if you find somebody who's willing to sell you, you know, who's willing to sell your product, you know, some a bicycle shop or a Target or a Best Buy or whatever it is, like, if you convince them to do it, they're going to want to do it like instantly. They're not going to be like, okay, well, in a year we'll do this. You know, they expect it to be ready. So you sort of have to have like a huge number of these products on hand before you've convinced everyone, before you can even, you know, get to the point of convincing everyone. The awesome thing about Kickstarter is it allows you to validate market desire of your product before you have to put in all of that.
Exactly. Like, in other words,
it basically allows you to and even better is it doesn't dilute your ownership of the company. So you can raise a few tens to even hundreds of thousands of dollars, not give up any of your equity in your company, get enough to get an initial batch going, and then you can go to basically any retailer in the country and be like, oh yeah, you know, 20,000 people have already given me $50 for this product. Mm-hmm. The product only costs $10. Like, you're going to sell this. What retailer is gonna say no to that?
It's the real estate issue, the real estate problem. Like, when you build a house for real estate, you have to have consumers already willing to purchase the property inside, whether it's a business, a commercial building, or a condo in the middle of Manhattan. You have to have people who are willing to spend the money on the promise. And Kickstarter's found that with the technology industry in terms of or the geek industry when it comes to content. For those people who want to spend that money. And basically, it's like better than Kiva because it's proving the need is there. It's solving a problem. And Kickstarter won't take off. It's a bullshit Kickstarter. You know?
Right. Yeah. Let's move on here before we get too tied up in this. Well, the last thing that I wanted to talk about that I was playing with this week is I rediscovered a game called The Stanley Parable. And The Stanley Parable is a mod for Half-Life 2. And it's one of the most thought-provoking and existential games I've ever played, despite the fact that it's incredibly low-tech, it's not very high-def, or it's all basically in the storytelling. It's an experimental, narrative-driven, first-person mod, and it'll really make you think about your role as a participant in game playing in general. But I highly recommend that everybody here who has Half-Life 2 on a PC or Mac, I can't help you if you've got it on the console only, but if you've got Half-Life 2 on a PC or Mac, download this and play it. Gameplay takes about 10 minutes. I'm going to say don't read anything about it. It's best to go in completely blind on this game. And the other tip I'm going to tell you is as soon as your game has ended, immediately go back and play it again, and you'll know what I mean when you play it. And that's all that I have to say about that. It's one of those games that when you play it, after you're done playing it, you're going to think about it for a long time afterwards. So that's Stanley Parable. It's a Half-Life mod, a mod for Half-Life 2, and we'll have the link in the show notes.
The Walking Dead game, which actually is really, it's funny that you brought up the Stanley Parable, because it sounds like there are elements of that in this game. It's kind of a series of short adventure-like games made by Telltale Games based on the Walking Dead comic. The style of it looks more like the comic, and it basically has nothing to do with the TV show, which I kind of hate now. So the TV show is terrible. This game is awesome, as are the comics, at least until things get really crazy. The game itself is cool. You start off as a convict who is just kind of caught up in the middle of all this. You see some characters like Glenn from the comic that everybody loves. But the really interesting thing is that this is an adventure game, and it forces you to make certain choices, and you have to live with those choices, too. So characters react to you differently. You know, certain characters can die entirely, and it also completely changes the plot moving forward, because right now there have been two episodes released, and if somebody died in the first episode, then you won't see them for the rest of the session. So,
the game is released in an episodic format.
Yeah, it's released like a comic book series.
That's wonderful. That's very
wonderful. Cool. And the episodes themselves are really, they're like 3 hours long or so, but they're just really fun and engaging with really good voice acting. The graphics are so-so, but the thing is, like, this game, you can play it on your Xbox, you can play it on your iPhone, on your iPad. It's pretty much everywhere now. It's really fun, really gets into the whole adventure gaming vibe. Like, that's something I've been missing for a while, and episode 2, which was released a couple months ago, has some really crazy choices in there. Like, there are consequences to this game, and you're kind of forced to live with them, which I really like. And the new episode is coming up sometime in the middle of this month, so now is a good time to catch up.
Or just play the game like 15 times, which is what I tend to do with those sorts of games.
Yeah.
Dwayne, how about yourself? What are you playing with this week?
Two things. I just discovered Bird Box. It's a startup out of Techstars. And what they do is you basically go on over to Bird Box, get an invite. Once you have an invite, you log into all of your photo sharing services, and it gives you a place right there to look at all of your photos. So it's really quite tight. And when I say all of them, I mean, like, you know, your Facebook stuff is there, and all the comments are there too. Your you know, anything you've done on YouTube is going to be there. Anything you've done on Flickr, you just log into these things, and they're using their APIs in order to pull this off. So it's a fledgling product right now, not to pun on the term Bird Box, but the idea is that you're going to one stop to get all your stuff, and they're eventually going to help you, share your box by being able to, like, punt your family over to the Facebook album or punt whatever. But for you, as a consumer, you get to see all of your content no matter how you posted it, and it doesn't matter if you continue to use your favorite apps like Instagram or whatever. You know, like, it just allows you to get in there. So that's kind of exciting. The next thing is, like, in about 3 days, I'm going to be more on OS X than I am on Windows.
Wow.
Which is a
milestone.
It's a mammoth change for Devinger and Chris, who, like, were around me in 2009, or Devinger, who's been around me since, like, 2001.
Too long.
It's a mammoth, like, change from the
I say, I remember your collections of media from back in the day, and they were kind of disgusting. So, not sure if things have changed at all.
So, are you going to be on OS X, or, in keeping with your love of Windows Classic, are you going to be on OS 9?
Wow, Chris, you pay attention a lot. Yeah, it's OS X. I think I'm going to leave my personal Mac Mini is going to hang out online for a while, just because it's a Core 2 Duo, and I'm going to wait and see if there's any issues before moving it over. But my office is throwing me a MacBook Pro, not the Retina, but, you know, the new one, Ivy Bridge and all that, 16 gigs of RAM and all that other stuff. And in part, it's because some of the work that I do involves going to sites that are treacherous for Windows computers and not treacherous for Apple computers. Well, not yet, anyway.
Not yet.
It's just funny because, yeah, I love iOS devices. I definitely dig them. And I've been playing with, you know, OS X at home for a while. I was a complete Apple person until, like, the year 1999. And now I'm just kind of going back, and I feel like on some level, I feel like I'm going to the dark side, but then I also feel like on some level I'm leaving the dark side, which makes me realize there's no light side anymore.
They should have gotten you the MacBook Air though, Dwayne.
So you're a jet existentialist now.
No, so, like, the computer that I'm using for work right now is a Dell XPS 15. So the Apple 15-inch machine is going to be much lighter.
Yeah.
But more than all that, like, the type of work that I do, the amount of research that I pull off, and the amount of, like, crunching power I need for I'm going to still have to use Excel via VMware Fusion. So I'm going to be, like, having an instance of Windows up for Excel through VMware Fusion. I need the power. I need
I need an Ivy Bridge chip, and I need 16 gigs of RAM to pull this off and not really miss a beat. So
that's a really interesting question I have for you guys. How much RAM do you guys use?
Uh-huh.
When I look at my usage in Windows, I'm using 80 to 90% at any given time.
But I mean, how much RAM do you have, and how much?
Every computer I own and use has at least 8 gigabytes.
Yeah. My desktop has 8 gigs right now. My MacBook Air has 4 gigs, and I feel like we've come to a point where 4 gigs should be the standard for any computer anybody buys. But I have a feeling that we're going to be stuck at this for a little while, just because RAM technology has actually gotten faster. So even if the capacity hasn't really changed much, you're still getting faster memory in newer computers.
And storage is much faster with the SSD.
Storage is much faster and
all
that.
So because storage is faster, your swap file doesn't hurt as much. Because I remember back in 01, I was using some of my RAM as a drive where I put my swap file via this driver. And
what? Yeah.
It was a hack.
Dwayne would go through many, many ways to tweak his performance.
Wait, you were taking up some of your RAM.
He was RAM driving.
To a drive
yes.
That was going to be your swap file.
Yes. Yep.
The whole point of a swap file being you've used up all your available RAM and so you're writing this.
Exactly. But you have to think about what the computers were like. In 2001, when I met Devendra, I was running a dual 1.13 gigahertz Pentium 3 with a gigabyte of RAM. A gigabyte of RAM in 2000.
A gig of RAM, guys. It's amazing.
A gig of RAM in 2001. Far more RAM than the operating system needed to run. But my problem was all the drives were still in IDE, like Ultra ATA or whatever. Right. So the drives were the bottleneck. So by putting a driver on that turned my 1 gig of RAM into effectively 512 megs of RAM, which is more than enough to run a system effectively back then, and getting a 512 gig drive for RAM for the swap
file.
But
how did you ever use up that full gig
in Windows? But it was funny because Devendra and I would be sitting there with the Windows, the task manager up, and we'd be trying to fill it up. We'd get up to like 500 megs, and we'd like open up more games and open up more things, and it would only really peak out at 750. So then that really made me realize, the other space is really being like wasted. So what happens is you go out, there are all these third-party little things online. I tried all of them. Many of them made my computer really unstable, but I found one that actually had worked. And I turned that into basically my computer had a drive. It was an H drive. And the H drive was where I was able to put my swap. I like convinced Windows to put my swap there. And the performance screamed for the time. Like the performance was far out of it was left field. It was amazing. I mean, this is a 133 megahertz chip of RAM. It was like a DIMM, a 133 megahertz DIMM, PC 133 or something like that. So, it's nothing compared to what we have today. But in terms of a dual 1 gigahertz machine with 512 megabytes of RAM and a RAM drive at 512 megabytes, it was the fastest thing you could have then.
I'm so glad that we don't have to deal with any of that stuff nowadays, that we don't have to worry about any of that stuff nowadays. It's all kind of done for us at the factory. Let's get into some of our headlines here. All right. So eBay this week invited some San Francisco users to a new same-day shipping service called eBay Now. An iOS app, eBay Now's beta, will let San Francisco residents get $5 same-day shipping on products from local stores. eBay Now could go head-to-head with Amazon, which is said to be planning warehouses in major cities to offer its own same-day shipping, which could shorten the wait for Amazon Prime users.
Up the tax.
Local sales tax for sure. Amazon CFO Tom Skutak said, "We don't see a way to do same day delivery on a broad scale economically during that company's Q2 earnings call." So I think this is great for eBay. I would love it to roll out to Amazon as well. I think that would be terrific. I do see, obviously limitations to this, but this could revolutionize the whole brick and mortar logistics in general. No need for anyone to go to the supermarket anymore if Amazon can deliver it the same day.
Think of the overhead for this. Like, think of the technology driving this, and think of the fact that this won't work in anywhere outside of like a really dense metropolitan area. I know. I feel like eBay has gone out on a limb to get this out first. But when was the last time eBay did something very interesting, guys? Yeah, you know, just think cool. about that.
Yeah, I don't know, guys. I feel like I mean, I don't want to sound complacent, but the idea that I can get stuff in my metropolitan area, which is like the fastest growing in the West or whatever, within 2 days, 2 business days, is really huge.
Mm-hmm.
But Colorado and Oklahoma both, there's no tax on Amazon right now because there's mm-hmm. no Amazon like warehouse or whatever in Colorado. And there's actually a court case that's staying Colorado from charging you sales tax. So personally, for me, the idea that they'd bring a warehouse into Denver or something would be a problem in terms of my cost bottom line when it comes to purchasing out here. So kind of hope they just stick to SF in New York if Amazon wants to do it. As for eBay, I think it's a smart move. It's a bold move. It's going to have to push Amazon. It's going to give them a lot of juice because eBay's been losing steam for a while. It also comes in line with their whole initiative to have more people just buying things now and not auctioning.
Mm-hmm.
So this is very interesting, and I'm excited that there's some movement in what's become, you know, the poster child of the early 21st century,
right?
But complete stagnation in terms of like what it's, you know, like you forget about eBay the way you forget about Yahoo.
Yeah,
more so. I mean, yeah. Yahoo, at least I remember as being something that I forget about.
Yeah,
eBay. Literally, I drive past it like every couple of days, and like that's literally the only time I like see their bill. I'm like, oh yeah, eBay.
Yeah. Well, they're doing cool things because they bought PayPal, like those sorts of
right.
things.
They bought PayPal like a decade ago. That's there's nothing awesome. Interesting
they did,
about
they
that.
Did. But PayPal, the way PayPal is working now is actually pretty different than it has like a decade ago. So like they're making movement now. They're doing stuff with mobile payments. They got that hardware out. It's moving, which is more interesting than eBay itself has been, you know, for a long time.
PayPal's moving, but at the same time, like Chris said, it was a long time ago. It took them a while to get PayPal up to speed. They bought Skype. They sold Skype, all that crap. But the thing is, for me, is that like the guy who they bought PayPal from is sending ships into space now.
Right.
You know, it's a whole new ball game for him. So where the hell has eBay been?
All right, let's move on here. The Windows 8 team this week started releasing Windows 8 to PC OEM and manufacturing partners, which means that the next milestone will be the availability of new models of PCs loaded with Windows 8, an online availability of Windows 8 on October 26th. So October 26th is coming up, and that'll be the new launch of Windows 8.
Yeah, so Windows 8, you guys hear about Metro? How it can't be called Metro?
Yes. Awkward.
Yeah.
That's all I got to say. Yeah, I mean, that to me is a sign of like, shows a sign of weakness on Microsoft's part to knuckle under to whatever small European company had Metro as a trademark. And also, I mean, isn't that the kind of thing that they should have like researched?
They should have researched it, and they should have paid them off. Because, I mean, you look at Apple on the iPad. They had to pay off ProView or whatever, right? Like, they paid them off because
the iPhone
multinational with company that wants the trademark.
The iPhone with Cisco. Wasn't it Cisco that had the iPhone before?
And they licensed the iPhone from Cisco, yep. Yeah. The iPhone name.
Let me...
Yeah. It's funny, too, because like we were at a point where people are finally beginning to understand what Metro was. Right. And mm-hmm. like it was finally getting into there, maybe not the general public, but it was a cool term that techie people and even like some mainstream journalists or some people would use to describe, look, this is how Windows 8 and Windows Phone is different. Now they're going to have to come up with something entirely new.
Right.
It's like probably what are they going to do? You know, you can't just rebrand awesome.
Right.
It kind of has to come up organically, which is the whole story that Metro has had.
Right. Yeah, no, they came up with some convoluted term. I can't even remember what it was, but it did.
Yeah, it's not going to stick around. Yeah. That's more for now, I guess.
All right, let's move on here. Beginning this fall, Square will begin processing all U.S. credit and debit card transactions at participating Starbucks stores across their 7,000 locations. Pay with Square users will be able to find a nearby Starbucks in the Square directory from their iPhone and Android smartphone. Additionally, Starbucks will be investing $25 million in Square for the company's Series D financing round. This, to me, this feels like, you know, when Oprah gives her nod to an author for her book club, that's what Starbucks is doing here with Square. Like, signing off on Square and investing in them like this, it's like, I feel...
This news has kind of ruined my life for the past 24 hours, because it's just been kind of a huge shitstorm, because I got a clandestine call yesterday mm-hmm. that something was happening at night. They wouldn't tell me what, and then, you know, so they wanted to get some press together for breakfast this morning related to the news they couldn't talk about. So I stayed up late just waiting for this news to drop. It dropped like a minute before I was going to, like, getting ready to go to bed. So I had to stay up late to write it. Then I had to get up early to do all this stuff. It's crazy, but what's most interesting about it is that Starbucks is literally going to be promoting Square within its stores, almost like ads. They want people to be using Square, not, I guess, partially because they're going to be investors in Square, but also the success of Square will pretty much be directly tied to the future of Starbucks. And Starbucks has been doing mobile payments for a long time now. They've been the most successful mobile payments provider in the country. So
in what
really
sense do you mean
more
than
the
most?
Hmm?
In what sense do you mean they've been the most successful sort of mobile?
I mean adoption. He means adoption. I spend a lot of time with restaurants mm-hmm. trying to get them to use mobile as a way to engage their customers on an online way, because you can track a mobile purchase much better than you can track an offline purchase. So there are people like – there are all these restaurants, and I'm not going to give a whole bunch of names, but there are all these household restaurants that are trying to come in there and chase Starbucks down with, you know, you can order online from your phone. You can order and then pick up from your phone. You can just show your – you have like a reward card, and you can just show your QR code, or you can just add more to your QR code directly from your bank account and all these other things. Starbucks has figured it out. Why? Because coffee is really manageable. People aren't buying necessarily whole meals when they buy their coffee. They're buying like coffee and a snack. And it's a manageable thing, and it's a small enough amount so that they're okay with using their phones. That was back in like 2008 or so. Mm-hmm. But now, because Starbucks has expanded its offerings, they're about to – in Seattle, they're about to open like a wine and cheese kind of place.
Huh.
They're doing all this stuff. They're trying to expand it. And the using the phone, using mobile phones in order to better position and you know, better track their online stuff and see what people are buying so that they can give them – discounts or receipt, yeah. Whatever, you know, they give you a receipt, like a treat receipt, that's what they call it, treat receipts, and have it all on their phone. They're cutting it off in terms of like the actual paper. They're better able to understand who their users are based on the online or their online purchases, and they're making things go faster. Their lines are shorter because of this, so they are the most successful. People are chasing
now. Well, to answer your question a little more directly though, Chris, Starbucks in the past year has processed 60 million mobile transactions. So that's purchases of people who are linking the Starbucks card via their apps on their phones. Mm-hmm. So they, you know, you just kind of just hold your phone up and the cashier takes a 2D barcode scan of your phone, boom, paid, whatever. And they've basically been doing more than a million transactions a week.
So Devendra,
so you compare this to like other like any other mobile payments provider where, or at least for single retailers, they haven't mm-hmm. really been able to figure out what makes mobile payments work.
So, yep. Devendra, yeah. I have a question for you. Now, it seems like from what you're saying, Starbucks has had they've had it all together as far
yes.
as mobile payments go already. So why the sudden mm-hmm. like confidence in Square, and why giving up all of that business to Square?
Good. Well, that was exactly really, my next question.
Yeah, they're not really giving up any business to Square. So to be clear, probably what's most interesting about this deal is that Square will be powering all of Starbucks' credit card mm-hmm. and debit card transactions.
It's the POS machine. They're going to be the new POS. The point
so
of sale.
So previously, you would rely. Previously, companies have to rely on like other bigger processors, and they have to pay all sorts of fees and deal with all sorts of headaches.
And bad equipment that doesn't ever get updated that costs
a
fortune.
Right. So now Starbucks is kind of just aligning itself with Square. It sounds like they're going to be getting a better transaction price too. Like they're going to be paying a smaller fee for every transaction, which is good for business. Like, first of all, that's great for Starbucks. They would not say how much of a savings they're having, Typically, Square people who use Square have to pay 2.75% of a for every swipe transaction. That's what goes to Square. Starbucks wouldn't admit like what they're actually paying. I assume it's going to be lower than that, but also lower than whatever they've been paying before. So it's a really interesting partnership because it'll let Starbucks save a lot of money. It gives them access to this technology for when they actually want to do more stuff with mobile payments. Like you walk up to Starbucks and you can check in and get your order immediately instead of like waiting till you get to the cashier. For Square, like it's just great exposure and extra money. And it doesn't hurt to have Howard Schultz on your company's board, you know?
Yeah, and it's not just extra money. This is life changing money for Square. This is like, absolutely. This is like if you had a windfall because Starbucks processes, you know, it's got stores. It's got like 600 stores in the country. Each store is hitting, you know, in the several tens, if not hundreds of thousands, depending on the area that they're in, every single day. And all those payments, if you can just shave off 0.25% off of what Square's rate is, which is fairly low already, then you're in excellent shape, and you don't have to deal with these point of sale vendors. And because Square is small, and because they're hungry, and because they're growing. Starbucks now has a big say in how point-of-sale devices go. So we're going to see Square have eventually the ability to expand and work in other verticals with their technology. That's going to be very big for both of them.
And to be clear, this is definitely not a profitable thing for Square. This is a marketing thing for Square.
Why would it be profitable for Square, dude? It's totally profitable.
Bulk discount for Starbucks, crazy volume for Square.
Yeah, I mean, I saw some analysis today.
On good authority that Square is not making any money off of this from people that I know there.
that would be interesting information.
That's what
Chris.
I would say if I were Square and I was giving PR talk. I would say,
yeah, I don't know. I mean, this is not official.
I also saw some analysis that pointed to like how much Square could potentially make from this whole deal because you know Starbucks does process quite a bit of transactions, and this partnership, to be clear, it's not just mobile transactions Square is going to be dealing with. It's all, every single transaction with a credit card.
It's online and offline, yeah.
Well, yeah, not just online and offline, but yeah, just credit card, whatever.
Well, I mean, offline is the credit card. That's what I meant. Like that's
Okay. That's, but really, like, it seems like this is just a much more interesting partnership than I think a lot of people are giving it credit for. I also want to point out, like, a lot of people hear this and they're like, so Starbucks is going to have those dongles on the on iPads or on iPhones for people to swipe their cards or something.
Really.
This partnership is all about the Pay with Square app, which is just an app that lets you pay for things without pulling out your wallet.
Yeah. It's essentially the previous Starbucks app, but
pretty much it's very, very
without the whole scanning aspect.
Yeah, although it sounds like that the Pay with Square app is going to get some sort of like barcode generation thing, so it'll work with the Starbucks equipment. That was one of the big things about this deal is that Starbucks already has all these barcode scanners, you know, the 2D barcode scanners. Yeah, they have them everywhere already, so they don't have to change anything to work with Square. Square just has to update its software a bit.
Yeah. So do you guys have you guys noticed any businesses that don't take cash anymore? I was actually in a clothing store the other day. It was it's called Go Light. They specialize in like outdoor gear. It's super light, high end, like super light gear. And they have a sign up, and the sign says, you know, will not, you know, no cash, no American Express, Visa, Mastercard, or Discover. So like, and cash is legal tender. So I don't know how they got around that. But in the end, I see what Starbucks is doing, and they're edging out the greenback users. Right, with all the options they're giving people, and you know, all these people have smartphones and everything. So it's very interesting to me to see how these private industries are changing the way we do commerce, which is kind of a legal government focused thing. So,
well, it's totally cool. I mean, they're totally taking the edge out of like Google Wallet and some of these other things.
Was there an edge to Google Wallet?
No, they're sort of taking the blunt knife that was Google Wallet and sort of whacking it against the wall, so now it's a bent doll. Yeah.
Well, Google Wallet or ISIS or any of the other, you know, so-called mobile payments competitors, this has been a really like crazy space, but Square has consistently shown that it's been able to like do it, like succeed and actually make something of mobile payments rather than just talk about it. Intuit's been around for a while too. Like they've been handling point of sale and stuff for small businesses, but you know, they're tied to TurboTax and they have all this other legacy software that they're dealing with. They're not dealing with the same sort of businesses that Square is. And I talked with Intuit today. They're not even interested in these sorts of like large scale deals like what Square is proposing. Mm-hmm. What's most interesting about the Square deal is that Starbucks actually went after them. It's not Square begging for money. Starbucks says, Howard Schultz said that, I have a good quote here somewhere, pretty much like every company, every big company that's been dealing with mobile payments was begging Starbucks to like come up with some sort of partnership because the Starbucks app has been doing very well. It says, they've been chasing ways to monetize mobile payments and payments in general. After talking to all these companies, one of Starbucks' digital strategy dudes told the CEO, check out Square. He had a conversation, and then it kind of clicked. But it's really interesting that Starbucks, who sought out Square, and not Square just begging for money. Square didn't even need this money.
There was a Quora thread I was reading recently about how basically, you know, initially Square's sort of strategy was explicitly aiming at essentially long tail real sort of point of sale, like coffee shops and, you know, taquerias and sort of stuff that was basically
flea markets, carts, farmers markets, the places where credit cards were not already accepted because it was too hard to get that point of sale device or whatever in the wild. That's where they were originally headed. So this is a big coup.
This sort of represents a bit of a change of direction for them in that respect. I mean, obviously not totally out of the way, probably pretty welcome, but certainly a little bit surprising if you've been following Square and their strategies. Although, I don't know, I think a good one. I mean, honestly, the ability to – my point previously about, you know, whether or not they're turning a profit on it, to some extent it doesn't matter. Like, they can now go to McDonald's and Burger King and, you know, every other large-scale, you know, seller out there and be like, hey – we can handle this volume and we can handle it at these price points and we can give you these advantages over it. And it'll give you, you know, a marketing boost to be able to say that you're doing this. And we can handle it, which I think is pretty awesome. It's got to put the traditional credit card processors, on pretty scary legs these days.
Yeah, I know Visa and MasterCard aren't going to be very happy about this, but actually American Express is kind of fine, I think, because their focus has never been to be a credit card company. They've always been a servicing company for their clients. And even though we know American Express through its charge cards, they've been around for a lot longer than charge card technology ever has been. So that's why they're doing their stuff with Foursquare and a couple other things in order to get things done. So this is very interesting in terms of like the fact that Square is coalescing this space by edging out, you know, PayPal just showed up with their stuff. PayPal's been trying to do the bump thing and all sort of stuff like that. And it's just as a personal finance piece, that's pretty much going to become universal because that's what Starbucks is in America. It's a big disruptive change for the way we pay for things.
It's a new milestone for Square for sure. And for mobile payments, I think.
Can I just say I'm so excited to see like startups doing stuff with mobile that's excuse my friend not bullshit. Like I, for so long we've seen like mobile startups be like, this is a mobile version social of Airbnb local. Social yeah, daily right, deals right. Sharing video Instagram clone, like just, I mean, what I mean, I know Jack Dorsey, this is, you know, his second or maybe even third company, I'm not sure. So he's pretty experienced, but like still it's nice to see somebody go out and be like, you know what, I'm going to create a company that's actually going to provide real value at a real point of pain for a huge segment of the economy. Mm-hmm. And they've executed just brilliantly. So kudos to them.
Yeah. I mean, Square's goal has always, you know, it's been to provide credit card service to individuals and small businesses. But ultimately, the long term goal is to make payments, the mechanics of it, disappear completely. Like, it's not, you know, it's what we see now with Pay with Square and some merchants where, you know, you could be a local, you could be a regular buyer there. And as you're walking up to the store, you know, you could pay just by showing your face. They'll see it pop up on the screen, and there's like geofencing going on that can actually detect when you're in the store. That sort of thing that's really easy, and you're actually talking to the cashier and not just handing them a card and staring blankly at the wall or something. So that's something that Starbucks was interested in too. So imagine actually having a conversation with your barista instead of like, you know, robotically saying your order over and over again.
What's going to happen when this is implemented in iOS 6's Passport?
It's completely seamless with Passport. It works perfectly with Passport.
Have you worked? I haven't played with it. I didn't know that they.
I mean, according to what reports that I've read, is that the whole barcode thing. It all fits within.
That's what's exciting. That's to me what's exciting, because with the geofencing and the Passport functionality, you really get what Devinger was just talking about. The idea that you walk in, oh, Devinger, how's it going? Your usual, yeah. Miss Barista person, and that's all. You bring it back to this actual interaction with people. And a lot of people are like, I don't want to deal with people. I just want to pay. But I don't think that's the case, because that's why retail still exists. You know,
For people who live in small communities, you can't help but know the people who you see every day when you're going to get coffee or something. You know, it's getting back to that small town vibe in a weird way, to a time where like credit meant the owner knew who you were. Right. And like they just took it on good faith. It's funny how technology is getting us back to a much simpler time in a way.
Never thought about that. That's interesting. All right. Let's move on here. Google has updated its search app for iOS to include voice-based questions and answers. It mirrors the functionality already introduced for Android 4.1. And in many ways, the functionality of Siri. The interface is clean, matching Google's open white space aesthetic and some swooping animations. The results are pretty identical to Jelly Bean's contextual awareness of where you are and what sort of thing you're searching for. As with Google now, it's also aware of who you are. For example, you could say, when is my flight? It will present your personal results. Google was careful to reiterate that Google Now is about ambient information cards, while voice search is a separate thing on Android 4.1. In other words, Google Now is not coming to its search app on iOS, just voice search. I saw the video for this, and it's hard to ignore the similarities between this and Siri, and I totally did not see this coming from Google, I have to admit.
Really?
Yeah, no.
This seems... extreme. I mean, given that Google's been working on voice since Google 411, and then with Google Voice and the voice search functionality was, you know, early on a sort of big feature of Android that was sort of forgotten about since no one sort of really used it. When Apple came out with Siri, you know, I think the opinion about Google was, hey, we did that first. How come we're not getting credit for it? And
it was very much like when Windows said, oh, we've had tablets for years.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. With the exact same sort of like, well, but having tablet isn't the same thing as making a tablet that people want to buy.
Yeah. It also means like we're going to see a lot more Google stuff on iOS in general. Like there's also the news that the latest beta of iOS 6 doesn't have the YouTube app. That's been included on the iPhone since it first came out, and that's because Google's working on its own, its own proprietary app.
There are a whole lot of reasons for that, but we're going to get into Apple headlines later.
They're all divorced. They're getting divorced and stuff. You know.
Can we please like pray to the tech gods that the YouTube app that Google comes out with will be better than like the Gmail app for iOS is terrible.
Yeah,
well, I mean, it looks pretty.
We don't need a YouTube app. We just need it to work on the browser. Like when you go to YouTube.com right now, you can play out of the browser. That's all we really need.
Yeah. All right. So let's before we get into the big chunk of Apple headlines, this is our next segment. Let's take a break here to talk a little bit about our sponsor, which is Audible.com. For our listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible has is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the audiobook I'd like to recommend this week is actually a radio dramatization. It's a dramatization of William F. Nolan's Logan's Run, which many people may remember from the the cheesy and cheesy slash awesome movie adaptation.
It's just awesome. You call it cheesy, and I will go to California and give you some brie.
I like it. No, I have to admit, I like it. The plot is, it's the 23rd century. At age 21, your life is over. Logan Six has been trained to kill, born and bred from conception to be the best of the best. His time is short, but before his life ends, he's got one final mission: find and destroy Sanctuary, a fabled haven for those who chose to defy the system. When Logan meets and falls in love with Jessica, he begins to question the very system he has sworn to protect. Soon they are both running for their lives. When your last day comes, will you lie down and die or run? So, I mean, this is kind of a plot that we've seen since then in tons of other, you know, B movie and other science fiction stories. But this in this case, it's a radio dramatization. I've heard some of this, and it's actually pretty neat. So, and I'd like to also wanted to point out this, because a lot of people forget that not everything on Audible is just a book, straight out book. But they do have tons of stuff like this, like these radio dramatizations, and they're fun to kind of get into. Anyway, that audiobook can be yours, as well as any of Audible's other 10,000 plus titles. And all you have to do is go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook and a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. We're going to take a little break here and listen to some music. And when we come back, let's get into some Apple headlines, as we know there's a ton of Apple headlines this week. So take a listen to this and come on back.
Every time I look into your loving eyes, I see love that money just can't buy.
Just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down live on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and social media and how it affects us. I'm here with Devinder Hadarwar, Duane DeFreitas, and Christopher Bernor, and there's a lot of Apple news this week. Let's start with the Apple Samsung trial. Apple, one of the world's most secretive companies, is finding there's a price in pushing its grievances against rival Samsung in federal court. Disclosure. In just the first few days of its patent trial this week, Apple has publicly discussed how it created the iPhone and iPad, showed early designs of the devices, and described intimate details about its product team. It also gave glimpses into its strategy and customers, and each fact, like an internal survey showing that 78% of iPhone users buy cases, was quickly disseminated and discussed in tweets and blog posts by people tracking the high-stakes case. There was a this is all in an article on Wall Street Journal. And I have to say that there was a slideshow that accompanied this article called The iPhone That Could Have Been. And I was really fascinated by this slideshow because it showed like different iterations of iPhone product design over the development of it. and they had some really interesting product design. Like there was one with a curved glass screen that kind of looks like a flattened bubble, and you know, one with curved ends. It's just a it's a cool little slideshow to take a look at, and it's like I'm so glad if for any sake that Apple has been forced to disclose this, I'm so glad that they have, in that we get a chance to look at some of these designs that could have been.
A lot of them look like remind me of like the Nokia Lumia 900, that kind of square, oblong thing. I mean, part of me is not. I'm not like really blown away by these images because the genius of Apple is convincing people that things just happen, that they're just magic. But anyone who's ever spent any time actually trying to develop anything knows that the amount of iterations that they go through before they actually get anywhere interesting, you know, the cutting room floor.
Well, that was one of the other like myths that was dispelled in the course of this trial is that Phil Schiller, who is Apple's senior vice president of worldwide marketing, mentioned a customer survey of iPhone buyers, which runs counter to Steve Jobs' prior statements that the company doesn't rely on focus group tools.
A customer survey is very different than a focus group.
Yeah,
a focus group happens, but it's pretty different. A focus group tends to happen before anything is launched in order to determine what design changes you should make before products go out. You can have a focus group afterwards, but you know, customer feedback
I'm sort of, I don't know. I mean, given how much Apple's been forced to divulge here, it really makes me wonder, like, can this possibly be worth it for them? I mean, so they get a few $1 million from Samsung. I mean, I guess what they must be hoping is that in one of these trials, they can get
shut everything
a
down.
Chilling effect, on the rest of the market. And they can basically make it so that other manufacturers are going to be much, much, much less likely to enter the market and much less likely to sell
Chris,
stuff.
I'm going to say something that you're going to be a little upset with about Patton. And you're not going to be upset because you're going to get angry. You might be upset for a different reason.
Okay.
This is ridiculous. You're upset. You're going to be upset because I'm going to agree with you also. And the reason I say that is because at the same time Apple's chasing – Apple, a company known for innovating and remaining 5 years – I mean when the iPhone came out in 2007, we think we're 5 years ahead of the competition. The Samsung Galaxy S3 just came out. It is the only thing that could touch the iPhone right now, I think, and it is 5 years later. You know, like they just got it, right? And then on top of that, Apple is rumored to be making this iPad mini, which directly goes against the 7-inch tablets that Steve Jobs was yelling about a long time ago. Now, you've heard Gruber. He's like, well, Steve Jobs was talking about this kind of thing and the resolution and all this other crap. But that's all crap. The fact is people have been making 7-inch tablets for a while, and Apple's going to downsize to capture that market, like how Porsche made the Cayenne car because they went into something that was priced in between their Boxster and their Carrera. And it's ridiculous that they would spend all this time and energy to defend something that they don't have to defend. They didn't have to defend the iPod. Like, the iPod showed up after a bunch of MP3 players, and even though it was after, it was better, so it made the money, and voila. And I feel like the iPhone showed up after a bunch of smartphones. They weren't capacitive touch smartphones. They weren't app-focused smartphones, but there were smartphones in the wild, and Apple came out after them, disrupted them all, and RIM is about to die. Mm-hmm. And I feel like they didn't need this. They didn't need this kind of scrutiny, this kind of like RIAA hunt down, shoot the little kid in the corner, ask him for all this money. They didn't need all that.
Yeah.
Steve Jobs is dying, and maybe it came to his brain that he had to like protect his legacy or something. But
well, we know he wanted to destroy Android, right?
Right.
And this whole trial is all about making a statement, right? It's not like Apple has kind of gone after other smaller Android manufacturers too, but Samsung is the biggest one and the most successful one. So to successfully make Samsung settle over potentially copying its designs, like that would be a big win for Apple. It's not
they
about
also the most egregious one. I'll give you that too.
Right. But it's not about the money, because really, if you think about it, like what Apple wants is to send the clear message that don't mess with us. You know, we're going to be releasing new products down the line, and don't copy us. Look at, you know, if you think you can be like Samsung and maybe have icons that look very similar to us or body designs that look very similar to ours, don't think that we'll just sit down so easily. It's a pretty, I think it's a pretty short-sighted way of looking at things, because clearly Apple wants to have its cake and eat it too.
Right.
I love when I get to use that phrase, because yeah, they're also going to be releasing 7-inch tablets, which, you know, probably won't look like the Samsung Galaxy Tab, which I think was the first 7-inch tablet, and it probably won't look like the Galaxy Nexus or the Nexus 7 either, which is made by Asus? Yes. At the same time, it's taking inspiration from the very idea that those things are successful and that there's a whole, you know, there's a market for it. During the trial, actually, Samsung revealed an internal email from Apple showing it was a post from a journalist, Kevin Toefel, Gigaom, actually. He was writing about how he gave up on the iPad and just went for the Galaxy Tab because it's smaller and it's more pocketable and you can actually walk around with it. You take it with you. And that's important. You can't really do that with the iPad. Mm-hmm. You honestly still can't really do that with the new iPad. So
you need a bag, You need a bag.
There's a really big use for the 7-inch tablet, and clearly Apple was interested in that, and they're going to be, I bet on them doing something with it this year.
Yeah. The thing that when I say is it worth it, I feel like, okay, so years ago, we're sitting down, Chris, DeVinger, and I said Samsung is the only one who can really compete with Apple. It's the vertical integration, the fact that they make all the parts, they make all the pieces they can get in here. And I feel like some of that early attack against HTC, against Nokia, against all the other stuff, Huawei, whatever. I feel like all that stuff was almost to set precedent so that they could go after Samsung in earnest, right? Because Samsung is the only true competitor to Apple when it comes to the scalability and the ability to get products into the hands of people across the world. So I feel like maybe that's something there, and that's the only reason I can fathom that Apple would have started this whole debacle in the first place, when they're so good at being ahead by just focusing on being ahead and not focusing on like chasing down would-be competitors.
This may be the last legacy of Steve Jobs, because it was pretty clear, you know, just reading the biography, that he was pretty pissed off about Android and about what Google was doing. And I think maybe with the iPhone, that's like, for Apple at least, it's probably one of the most singularly unique inventions for this company, right? They, you know, the Mac was...
And the most vulnerable.
Yeah, and the most vulnerable, the most successful device too for Apple. Like, this is like Apple bringing all of its computing talent, all of its media talent into a single device and kind of just leaping an entire industry forward in a way we never expected. So, of course, they're going to be really protective. I have a feeling, though, if Tim Cook was in charge several years ago when all this went down, he wouldn't be so crazy about, you know, actually pursuing all these companies. Steve Jobs takes things personally, as we've seen many times, or at least I've read about in many stories. We saw what happened when, Bill Gates stole the GUI for Windows, all of that stuff. Like, this feels like a real personal vendetta in a way against Google.
Like, he's trying to make an example. Like, he's trying to
say,
like, you did it to us before, I can't let them do it to us again.
Yeah,
that kind of
but
stuff.
You know, realistically, you can't continue to exist in this vacuum where you believe that things aren't, products aren't inspired by other products. That's just the way it is.
That's how it is. There's an evolution. That's how it is with
design.
With design of all types, whether any kind of art, right? If we're going to call this art, but like you think about like any story we've ever seen, everything is a remix. Any technology has been built on the shoulders of others. And I'm not saying that Apple shouldn't be like, hey, let's get a licensing deal up together or something like that. Because they could have talked – if they went to Samsung and said, look, it's clear you took our stuff. Let's have a licensing deal. Let's say that you can like use part of it in this part and let's get to an agreement instead of this like worldwide massive patent and design war that is like, you know, taking every startup and making them cower in the corner. It's massively disruptive in a negative way.
Yeah.
You know, I think Apple is honestly, they're very, very, very good at innovating. But I certainly think that, like, honestly, their strength is their weakness here. Mm-hmm. Honestly, the only product I can think of ever that's dominated its market that Apple's produced has been the iPod. Just about everything else they've ever done. Well, which came after OS X I mean, honestly, even then, towards the end, you know, the only reason why it sort of ended up winning is because Apple sort of brought things forward into the iPhone, and so now the iPhone has sort of taken its place. But like every other product that Apple's done, no matter how imaginative and everything, it's so like the opinionation in it and the thoughtfulness in it that makes it so great is the same thing that makes it sort of limited in its mass market appeal. Because it ends up being more expensive, it ends up being, you know, certainly far better, but not, you know, if you can cut a few corners and make it a few hundred dollars cheaper, you know, people will buy an inferior product. That's how markets work. You know, there are people who are willing to spend more, you know, for, you know, the super awesome indie bands, and there's people who are willing to just go out and buy the newest whatever, you know, mass produced band is. And I think Apple is sort of trying to like not lose the smartphone and tablet market the way they lost the PC market. But I don't think that this is actually their weakness. Their weakness is not people copying them. Their weakness is, ironically, the thing that makes them great. It's their opinionation. It's their dedication to quality.
And they're arguably more vulnerable with mobile than they were with desktops, because with desktops, at least, the differentiation exists on all sorts of levels. And you hold onto a desktop theoretically for several years, whereas with a cell phone, that flip out happens, you know, in months for some people. The iPhone, the sixth iPhone is coming out in September, and the fifth iPhone came out in October. So this is an 11-month transition for Apple, which means if people are going to upgrade from the 4S to whatever comes next, it's not even a year. And that's a very aggressive. So it's I didn't see it before, but on some levels, it's a very aggressive scale to maintain that level of innovation. The iPod was there's still an iPod Classic. It hasn't really changed, you know, dramatically. In the same way the iPhone has. We look at iPhone, the first iPhone to the fifth iPhone to what we think is going to be the sixth iPhone. So I could see why Jobs was scared that the same thing was going to happen, that they were going to lose their eggs, they were going to be put on the outside. Especially when they started making their own chip, because that was definitely history repeating itself. So it's just interesting to me that this doesn't seem worth it in the court of public opinion. That's kind of strange. Just like, you know, not having USB 3 wouldn't seem worth it in the court of public opinion, or HDMI ports or whatever. So, you know, maybe like you said, with Tim Cook, we'll see a direction that is probably more possibly more pragmatic and less zealous.
So we briefly mentioned before in the last segment that the newest version of iOS 6 will no longer have the YouTube app. Apple says that its license to include YouTube in iOS has expired. But Google is going to be making a new YouTube app that will be available in the App Store. And frankly, I'm okay with this, because this will allow Google to continue to evolve that app and add more features, and it'll be an evolving product instead of just kind of this locked in time app that really didn't have a broad amount of functionality as it is.
Is awful. It is an awful application of YouTube. It is a terrible thing. You can't search for everything. If you hit something in Google, you type in like Rick Rolling video, and it shows up when you hit it. It goes to the YouTube app, and then it says it can't play it. It just needs to go away. Like, it just needs to go. Like, I'm adamant about that.
Honestly, I hate to say this, I wish somebody besides Google was making it, though. Google has not, and this is aside from my general anti-Googleness. Like, Google has not shown themselves to be any good at making iOS apps. Their Gmail app is terrible.
Plus apps are pretty great. So
the
new Google Plus app is pretty great.
Yeah, so, I would say so.
Yeah, they've learned.
Oh, Google Plus app on the iPad is fantastic.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they've learned quite a bit. It's kind of shocking that it's taken them so long, but you know what? This is my standard argument whenever this comes up, though. At least they're making apps for other people's platforms, right,
Apple? Amen.
Right? Yeah. But I guess Apple doesn't care, so whatever.
Yeah. I mean, I think that the thing is,
I kind of hope this is a trend. I was you know, Apple's redoing the Maps application, and you know, it's got all these great features. But to be honest, if you're on a 3GS, you're losing features with the iOS 6 version of Maps than you did with the iOS 5 version of Maps, because you're losing the ability to, like, in certain areas to take a look at what the transit scene is, because that's built in with the Google stuff. And you're losing the ability to Street View. In light of this new flyover thing. And to be honest, flyover is not as helpful as Street View. Yeah, it's pretty, but it's nowhere near as helpful as Street View. So I feel like if Google could show up with a Maps application that gave the kind of functionality that we're interested in, that'd be great. But I'm worried that they're going to say, well, if you want a great Maps app, you better come over to Android. Because that's a crux that they can use if they decide to use it. Then again, Amazon showing up with an app on the iPad shows that, you know, other companies don't think the way Apple does. So.
All right, let's move on here. iMore has learned that Apple intends to update their entire line of iOS device products to support the new miniaturized dock connector, and to do it as early as the rumored September 12th special event this fall. This would include the new iPhone 5 or the new iPhone, whatever. Every time I say iPhone 5, Dwayne gets on me about... We don't know what
it's a mistake to call it the iPhone.
We don't know what it's called. Sure, Dwayne.
It doesn't matter. It's going to be called the iPhone.
We just need to call something. This is language, Dwayne. Come on. We need to give it some sort of signifier.
The sixth iPhone. That's all I'm saying. That's all. We know. That's what we know. We know it's the sixth one. That's what we know.
It will include the sixth iPhone, whatever it's called. The new iPod Nano, the iPod Touch, the rumored 7-inch iPad Mini, and the updated version of the current 9.7-inch iPad. So, across the board.
Are they saying that the 9.7-inch iPad will be refreshed in September to include a dock? Because I read that, and I was like, I don't really get it. Why would
I don't think so.
Yeah, it's going to wait until it's next.
They're just saying, basically, moving forward, all of them are going to have this dock connector across the board.
Sure, of course. Why would they have two if they can have one? Right. This is obvious. It's like NPR.
Yay, doc. I mean, what else is there to say about this story, right?
Well, I do have one thing to say about this. The idea that they are going to move this dock to smaller connector, and that there is going to be theoretically the jack for your headphones on the bottom, means that the docks that people have may like the new docks that, like, you know, accessory makers make may also, like, they may also have a little one of those headphone jack things sticking up the bottom for either stability or for information, the way the iPod Shuffle does, that dock. So that's, to me, that's kind of interesting. The idea that you can have a stupid-ish dock that allows for sound to be transmitted through it without having the fancy chip for the iPhone connector and all that stuff. So that's all I was going to say.
Rumored next generation iPhones with taller displays feature a home screen that scales to 5 rows of icons, according to sources. The current 3.5-inch iPhone display features 4 rows of icons. This week, proof emerged that Apple is at least testing next-generation iPhone displays that are taller.
5 rows of icons,
yes.
Andy? My God.
I don't know if I can take that change.
Although, as we've learned from the Samsung trial, I mean, this is... And this sort of proves what we've if you follow Apple, every product release, and it's, you know, somebody comes out with like a blurry picture of something that looks like it could be the new iPhone. And as we learned from Samsung, Apple prototypes stuff, and it doesn't always look like the one that comes out. On the other hand, you know, look at the iPod, and the iPod, especially the Nano, changed dramatically every other generation to an entirely different form factor. So it's honestly kind of amazing that the iPhone has remained as unchanged as it has.
Yeah. You get conservative about your breadwinner.
Yeah. What's interesting, too, about the all the leaked documents was that Apple was clearly working on the iPhone 4 design as this sort of like long play. They couldn't get it done initially for the first iPhone, but they had this in mind for a long time. So I'm wondering if, you know, with the next iPhone, the iPhone 5 or 6 or whatever, it'll probably just be called iPhone, like the new iPad thing, which is just kind of annoying and hard to talk about. But it'll be interesting to see just how much this design kind of relates to some of the older ones. I'm making fun of it, but I'm definitely going to buy one like immediately, because after testing so many Android phones, I don't think I can ever move over full time to Android, and I kind of need more space on my iPhone. So
how much space do you have on your iPhone now?
No, screen space.
Oh, screen space. I hear you.
Screen space. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, the S3, I got to say, the S3 does come close. I'm impressed with the S3. I'm actually a little impressed with the Galaxy Nexus, but I'm really impressed with the S3. I remember seeing some article that said you could watch video and write email at the same time and started laughing at it. It's because it's funny, right? Like, who does that?
But you know what? What's great now about Android is that you can just get a Galaxy Nexus 200 or Galaxy 7, $200, no contract, no dealing with any of that. You get to play around with Android apps when you want to. Yep. But, you know, for me, especially when it comes to games and media apps, iOS is still kind of the king when it comes to that stuff. So you have a much better alternative to play around with Android now.
When Chris Brenner and Dwayne Freitas have iPhones,
I know, right?
Like, there's something going. Like, the market is skewed, you know. Like,
yeah.
All right, let's move on here to our final Apple headline. On and this is a doozy. On Friday, August 3rd, Wired reporter Matt Honan was playing with his daughter when his iPhone suddenly powered down. He went to plug it back in when it rebooted to the setup screen. He went to connect the iPhone to his computer and restore it from that backup. When he opened his laptop, an iCal message popped up telling him that his Gmail account information was wrong. Then the screen went gray and asked for a 4-digit PIN. He didn't have a 4-digit PIN. By then, he knew something was very, very wrong. For the first time, it occurred to him that he was being hacked. According to Apple's tech support records, someone called AppleCare claiming to be him. Apple says the caller reported that he couldn't get into his .me email. In response, Apple issued a temporary password. It did this despite the caller's inability to answer security questions that he had set up, and it did this after the hacker supplied only two pieces of information that anyone with an internet connection and a phone can discover.
Dudes, the two things about this story. One, first rule, don't play with your daughter, because this is the kind of stuff that happens.
And don't save all your pictures of your daughter on your laptop.
And second rule, if you haven't watched The Net with Sandra Bullock, now is the time. If you have an Apple ID and you haven't watched The Net, you need to watch it immediately. Because
that
clearly
movie will prepare you for everything in life.
Exactly.
So basically, hackers... hackers used his billing address and the last 4 digits of his credit card number to get the changes made on his iCloud account. And they got the last 4 digits of his credit card number using a social engineering hack on Amazon.com. So, and all of this was just basically to get access to his Twitter. But as a result, they wiped his iPhone. They wiped his laptop. And basically fucked his life over, his online life over.
And the scary thing is one of those things where, I mean, having secure, I mean, about the only solution to preventing something like this is just simply not having cloud stuff. I mean, this basically pushes everyone's fears about the cloud. I mean, it doesn't matter what his passwords were. It doesn't matter, you know, what his,
I gotta,
you know, how secure he was.
I gotta disagree, only because, like, he, okay, so here's the deal. When you have one card that you use, you expose yourself. Yes, everybody wants to have as many points as possible so they want to use one card for all their purchases. I'm a victim of this as well. But, you know, like, first of all, when it comes to your Gmail account, you know, the backup account should not be another Gmail account if you can help it. Get a Yahoo account. Get an account that doesn't have your name as an alias or your name as the actual thing, so people can't go out and find that. When you have your Apple account, you know, possibly make the credit card number that you're using for your Apple account different from the one that you're using for your other main account, if that's Amazon, if that's anything else. If you can diversify the ways in which you pay, then do so. Because you have things like, you know, for instance, with Amazon, you can pay with PayPal, whatever. So unless you're really stocked up on, like, trying to, like, become like a travel hacker with all your points or whatever, you can take steps to maintain your cloud-based life without having everything completely linked to one another, which precludes you, not precludes, that's a bad word, which keeps you from falling victim to this totally integrated setup. Obviously, also part of the problem here is also the whole, like, branding of yourself. If your name is Dwayne D on everything, like it is for me, you're a little bit more vulnerable than if you've been using different aliases here, there, and everywhere. So I think that yes, obviously, like there are cloud fears that are being realized here, but I think that the big problem here was that he was completely integrated, and he even used the term daisy chained in terms of the way his accounts are set up. And that's the big difference, Chris. You don't have to daisy chain your stuff. You can take measures. Even now, one of my coworkers set it up so that when he changes his password on Google, Google will send him a text message with a code in it that he has to confirm in the screen he's using. Mm-hmm. So you can do this. You can make it work. They have we've been lazy about it. And if you have a legacy account, you've got like a crappy password because they didn't use the they force you to make better ones. But I had a password. It was like Puka. Like, what the hell?
you can set two-factor authentication on Google now, which is or on Gmail, which is especially useful. But go ahead, Chris.
But yes, those are all great best practices. The scary thing about this one is the only thing that would have the only thing that would have prevented this from being able to happen is if he had used a different credit card to pay for his iCloud account from his Amazon account, right?
I mean, that's really the same email.
Well, no. There's one big thing that would have prevented all of this, right? The Apple person.
Okay. That he could have controlled. I mean, that was going to be my point, is that this was fundamentally a flaw in Apple security practices. Taking, you know, the last four digits of your credit card are considered
everywhere.
Moderately public information. Yeah, that's usually how your credit card is identified. So the fact that just simply by getting a hold of those last four digits, that was enough to take ownership of the account. It didn't matter what his password was. It didn't matter what his security question was. It didn't matter anything. The only thing that did was just simply the link between the two. Now, granted, you know, the hacker was able to determine, you know, that this was his iCloud account and his Amazon account. But actually, by calling technical support and just simply identifying as him, it's not entirely clear that they actually needed to know his email
that is true.
Or identity at all. They just simply needed to find out where he lived, and that's moderately public information.
Mm-hmm. It's a reminder that some of the greatest hacking is all about social engineering.
Yeah. It's legwork, man.
Yeah,
it's...
I'm actually surprised that more things like this haven't happened. People are talking about how this is like a failure of the cloud, and it's a failure of our modern, all of our modern services. Guys, like stuff like this would have... I'm shocked that this isn't happening more often.
Common sense on policy.
That's true. But also, like, our services, they're actually doing what they're supposed to do. It's the people that are that was at least the problem here.
Build a better mousetrap, and you'll just find a better mouse. So build an idiot-proof, tool, and you'll get a bigger idiot. And that's kind of part of what's happening here.
And in fact, like, Amazon has changed their customer privacy policies. Mm-hmm. They've previously allowed people to call in and change their email address, but they've cut
a whole bunch of jobs in India by saying you can't call in anymore.
They no longer allow people to call in and change account settings such as credit cards or email addresses. Apple has temporarily, at least, stopped processing Apple ID password changes over the phone. We're not sure what their new policy is going to be, if anything, or if this is just basically a temporary shunt to while all of this kind of blows over.
But they have thrown some things up there. Like, for instance, in iOS 6, you're forced to put security questions in place for your Apple ID when you're in the App Store. So that's a thing. I do think that there is a time when you need to call up. Like, if you don't have access to something, or like you don't have access to your like desktop, you just have your iOS device or whatever, your iPhone or whatever, you might need to call up. And I do think that there's got to be some way, because like when I call up my bank, they're asking me questions that I'm okay with answering that get me in there. I'm not saying I want Apple to have my social security number, but if they're able to read my my three security questions and I'm not dumb enough or lazy enough to make my answer all the same thing just because I'm too lazy to actually think about my security questions, there is something there. I think there needs to be a slightly better way of doing this without having any kind of weird biometric voice scan, eye scan, hand scan, finger scan, crap. I don't know the answer, but I do think that it's probably best if we figure out these kinds of things in a way that's manageable, But in a way, it doesn't annoy people, because I think that right now a lot of people are upset that they have to put like a special character in their password. And I think this is part of the whole thing where we've tried to dumb down all the technology so much that, you know, because the consumer. But we've forgotten like the fact that, you know, this stuff is sensitive and it needs to be respected, and consumers should understand why it is that they're going through some of these hoops, and it's to protect them. Mm-hmm. And I think there's been a lot of fear around that, and especially because Apple likes to tout the amount of, you know, users with credit cards it has, so it just wants more users, like everybody else wants more users. So
So one thing which one can do, which is my strategy, I don't use security codes, security questions at all. I think the security questions are by far the weakest link. So whenever I come to a site that requires a security question,
I use the exact same answer.
No, I have a script which generates a 64-character uppercase, lowercase, and numbers and punctuation random string, which I use as my answer to my security question. Because I seriously consider that to be by far
what's it called, the whole time? So it's a new string for every single question. So if I ask
every single one. Yep.
So and you keep that in what, one password or something? Like, where do you keep that?
I just have a script that generates it.
No, but where do you keep that when you need to answer those questions?
Yeah.
Where do I keep what? I never answer the questions. So if you forget my password.
So okay. You're just screwed if you forget your password. So where, a better technique, guys?
For
those questions, the best thing to do is not to use publicly available information. So stuff like, what city was your high school in, or where were you born? Stuff like that. You can often choose what your security questions are. Just avoid those. I like to use really weird answers for some of them, and I've just kind of been using them consistently, and that's kind of saved me so far.
Right. Yeah, I mean, there are things that I can't, like, what's your favorite TV show? You know, like, some people know what my favorite TV show is, but, you know, most people really don't. And they'd have to really start digging to find out what my favorite TV show is. You know, what was the name of that pet you had? You know, who knows?
And things like
that
you never mention in public forums or online.
Well, except those things can be searched. Like those, you just throw a dictionary and just something to hammer away at those, you know, password forums, and they can eventually land on something.
A lot of those password forums, once you start answering those questions incorrectly more than X amount of times, it's like, okay, we're shutting it down. It's clear that you're trying to do a brute force attack on this thing. So it's a moderation. I think Chris's strategy is crazy.
That's the first time you've ever said that about me instead of the other way around. I'm sort of proud.
It's been a day of brewer. But I think Dimitri's got a point. Like, and Andy too. Like, you have to figure out something that's not going to be publicly available, but that resonates with you, such that if you do forget your password, and you should every once in a while, it's going to happen, unless you're the type of person to write it down somewhere and leave it for other people to find, even if it's in your Evernote. You know, you have to like just be worried about that kind of thing. So I don't know. One password is helpful.
Yeah.
I use one thing I should say. LastPass is a spectacular, spectacular service.
So that's the same thing as 1Password. You're trusting your passwords to the cloud, which is the whole problem that this whole article and story had from its inception, that there's a bit too much reliance on the cloud. So, you know, there's no clean and easy way. There's no foolproof way. But it's sort of like freedom. The price you pay for freedom is not being completely free. The price you pay for all these cloud services is knowing that they are somewhat vulnerable. But the convenience is just so great that you can't step away from it.
Right. Well,
Duane DeFreitas, the Thomas Paine of the cloud.
The takeaway that I got from all of this is that basically there's no easy solution. The solution is that you have to put some effort into maintaining your own personal security online, and that's just the bottom line. It's, you know, you don't use common passwords on multiple sites, and you change your password up every once in a while, and
for the love of God, backup.
Yes,
come on.
Spinger, remember when I used to say that I wanted a machine that was totally off the grid, that was totally standalone, right? Like, that's the only way you can be okay. You can't do anything.
It's so easy now, people. Come on.
No.
Yeah.
All right. Any last other points anybody wants to talk about before we close it off for the evening?
No. I will tell you guys one thing. I think I've pretty much decided I'm just going to buy a Surface when it comes out.
Really?
Like that is going to be my de facto Windows 8 machine. Wow. Are you with me? everyone.
I've got
we're all leaving Windows. It's that bad now.
I've currently got Windows.
Wait, no, it's going Windows. Windows 8.
I've got Windows 8 beta running on the boot camp on my MacBook Air, so I think I'm going to stick with that for a while.
Yeah, at least from everything I've tested, Windows 8, you really need some sort of touchscreen to really take advantage of that OS. And I think after seeing what we've seen of the Surface so far and knowing how I like to use what I've always wanted in a tablet, I think a Surface would be kind of perfect for my uses.
Well, you know what would be ideal?
And tape them together and make a courier.
What would be ideal is, you know how OnLive, there's an OnLive app right now for the iPad that kind of remotely serves Windows 7. Like, it would be great if they were to, like, I talked to those guys at OnLive over at during one of, I think it was during E3, and they said they do have plans in the works to bring the whole gaming platform to the iPad. And I would love to see them bring Windows 8 to the iPad via virtual desktop through that app as well.
That sounds like a rough user experience.
It's really, really smooth. If you try the OnLive app on the iPad right now, it's super smooth. Lets you run Microsoft Outlook and Microsoft Word and Excel and a couple other, like, presentation, I think. So
sounds good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, Demetri, is the Surface running Windows RT or running Windows, like, you
can install stuff? No, so there are two versions of the Surface, and this we talked about this when it was first announced, but there's the Windows RT one, which is thinner, lighter, and will likely be cheaper, and then there's the Windows 8 Pro one, which is a little thicker and can actually run all older Windows apps.
I thought you were going for the RT one. That's why I thought you were leaving.
No, I'm going for the Windows RT one. That's what I'm saying. But that's my goal with computers have always been, or I want something super portable, super thin, and I can take with me pretty much everywhere. The Courier was sort of that dream machine for me, and I feel like the Surface could end up being that eventually.
But you can't install your programs on it.
My older programs, sure, but I think that Windows 8 App Store will populate pretty quickly. I think it'll be fine, yeah.
All right, let's go around the table here. I'm going to start with you, Devendra. Where can we find you online when you're not here on the Drill Down?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at twitter.com/Devendra. I podcast about movies and TV at /film.com. And I write about technology at venturebeat.com. Everything else I do is at devendra.org.
Dwayne, how about yourself? Where can we find you online?
Find me at twitter.com/DwayneD, DWAYNED. You can also find me at flavorsonme /DwayneD, and you can begin to see some of my writing on interimnewmedia.com. Our blog will have a little bit.
Chris, how about yourself? Where can we find your work online?
You can find me always on Twitter at Chris Bernor, CHRSBURNOR. And then I curate a list of awesome tech events and startup-related articles at the Startup Digest. You can get that at startupdigest.com. And if you want to see my most recent development experiment, I just recently launched an experimental dating site at cupidcurated.com.
Nice.
Which is in private beta, so,
right.
You know.
Send me the private beta credentials, man.
Wait a minute.
Yeah, I'm kidding.
Yeah, don't tell Gina.
Wait, this is the married man who's got the dating site. I don't know.
I just keep the service running. I didn't say I was using it.
He just wants to make money.
Money!
As for myself, you can...
Back to the Wikipedia conversation. I'm sorry. Go back to Andy Sanders.
You can find me at MrBabyMan.com. gplus.to/MrBabyMan, where you can find all my social links. It's my Google Plus account. I want to take an opportunity to plug the fantastically creative TV show that I'm working on right now, which is called Gravity Falls. If you've got kids and you're watching the Disney Channel, tune in. You can check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes by going to geeksofdoom.com, and our subscription link is there in the right-hand sidebar on the very top of the screen. Our show is on Stitcher, and I want to thank the Stitcher audience who is downloading and tuning in
to our show. They've single-handedly managed to boost our listenership quite a bit. You can listen to us on your iPhone, Android phone, Kindle Fire, and other devices. Go to your app store or at Stitcher.com for that. Facebook.com/TheDrillDown, Twitter.com/TheDrillDown. Sign up at j.mp/subus to get SMS alerts when The Drill Down goes live. If you got an idea for a story you think we should be talking about, tweet us or email us at comments@thedrilldown.com. If you got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on The Drill Down. Let The Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our wonderful audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.
We all live in the age of information.
We're sitting on the most perfect beach in the world, and all we can think about is
where can I hook up my modem?
Every trace of our existence is computerized. Everything about us is encoded somewhere on a complex network of information.
Computers, your life, aren't they?
Yes. Perfect hiding place.
Computer analyst Angela Bennett was just doing her job.
My God.
When she stumbled onto something.
What is this?
She never should have seen.
I plugged it in and I'm staring at the personal medical files of the Undersecretary of Defense, Michael Bergstrom.
Someone's tapped into the system.
How long would it take to track her?
Depends on how long she stays online.
Something.
Why would anybody want to do any of this?
That reaches farther than she could ever imagine.
They hacked into computers and they caused this chaos. Wall Street.
The market panicked as officials suspended trading.
The Department of Water and Power in Atlanta. LAX.
We've lost radar contact.
Now.
It's time to go.
They're manipulating her world.
You can make of reality what we choose.
According to the Department of Motor Vehicles, you're Ruth Marks.
They've screwed with my information and my fingerprints. I don't understand. Why me?
Infiltrating her life.
Find whoever she's been speaking to.
No, he was not a diabetic. Where?
And erasing her identity.
We've got an outstanding warrant for Ruth Marks on federal charges.
I am Angela Bennett!
Just give us the disc and we'll give you your life back.
She has the evidence.
She's copied the disc.
Clever girl.
But they have the power. This summer, Sandra Bullock is caught in the net. A film by Urban Winkler.